Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. And you can follow the best of our conversations on Twitter with hashtag InforumSF. I'm Daniel Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music, and I'm a professor of psychology and behavioral neuroscience at McGill University. And tonight, I'm delighted to introduce you to my friend Alex DeGrassi, one of my favorite guitarists and composers. And he's also a Grammy Award-nominated fingerstyle guitarist. He discovered the guitar at a young age and is a UC Berkeley alum and has played at notable venues such as the Montreux Jazz Festival, Carnegie Hall, and Wolf Trap. So, let's get started.
All right.
I think one of the things I'd like to start with is just to say that in the last 15 or 20 years of my research, one of the things that I found most surprising as a musician myself in exploring music in the brain was how, I guess, discovering where it is that music is. I always imagined as a player that the music was in my fingers. And now I know that it's in the brain and in neural representations of the fingers. And in fact, that music is in every part of the brain that we've so far mapped. There's no region of the brain that doesn't have something to do with music. And I found that very surprising. And I wonder if, from your perspective as a player, if you find that surprising or what your own intuitions were coming into it.
I think my intuition is that music is something that gets sort of received in some sense of it or another, like radio, like something that you pick up. You know, it's a vibration. So, for example, when I've written my own music for guitar, a lot of times it's the result of having experienced something and somehow absorbed it, just like you might absorb a vibration or you might absorb light or you might experience some rhythmic experience, like walking down the street.
A lot of composers say that they feel they're not really creating the music. They're channeling it. Roseanne Cash talks about just holding up her catcher's mitt. It's just she catches one as it goes by. And Victor Wooten, the bass player, talks about there being the music is everywhere. It's for anyone to take. You just have to tune into it. Is that what it feels like for you?
I think so. You know, driving down here today, there was a rough patch of road because there was road construction, and you know, you actually feeling the road, and it makes you aware that no matter where you are or what you're doing, you could be falling asleep and listening to your own breath. You hear some kind of rhythm, and you hear something maybe rise out of that rhythm. And for me, personally, a lot of times the idea for writing a piece of music or making an arrangement comes from some sort of rhythm. So a lot of people would say, well, do you get the melody first or do you get the rhythm? I always say I get the rhythm first, the melody comes out of it.
Could you play us an example of something where the rhythm came first, and maybe just play the rhythm before you play?
Sure, I'll try.
Let's see.
This is a piece called Cumulus Rising, or I'm just going to play a little bit of it.
This is from Turning, Turning Back.
This is actually from a recording I did in 98 called The Water Garden.
Oh, that's right.
And a lot of the pieces are sort of on the theme of water, and this one is sort of water rising in the form of a cumulus cloud, but it doesn't have to be, but that's just my own experience and sensation that kind of gave me the idea. So this has a sort of sensation for me of being something rising upwards.
So if you could play the rhythm first and then the piece, that would be interesting, I think.
So I'll just tap the rhythm, so.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty simple. And then I'll play a little bit of it. So it goes.
One of the things that people often ask is what's happening in our brains when we hear a piece of music, and it's really extraordinarily complicated. So the sound enters the ears, and there's a whole cascade of very complicated processes that turn the changes in air pressure to an electrical signal, which gets transmitted from the ear to the brain. And then once it hits the brain, it gets even more complicated, because it turns out there are distinct regions of the brain that process different aspects of the sound. So one part of the brain is a special, you can think of it as a special purpose circuit that's just attending to and processing the rhythm. And then there's a separate part that's processing the pitch, a separate part that's combining those pitches and durations into a melody, stringing together the elements into melody. There's a part separate from that that's attending to how loud or how soft it is. And it all comes together later, and we get this seamless impression of this beautiful melody and harmony. And yet it's processed piecemeal. And one of the sources of information for this is that we've seen patients who have damage to one very particular focal portion of the brain, and they lose one of those elements while retaining the others. So they might lose rhythm but still have pitch and harmony, or they'll lose pitch but still have harmony and rhythm.
So does it get processed in real time? I mean, all these elements, do they get processed simultaneously?
Yeah, but so quickly. I say it all comes together later, later in brain time means maybe 30 milliseconds, 30 thousandths of a second later. Mm-hmm. But at any time, it can be disrupted. Due to organic brain injury or trauma, it can be disrupted. But it's really remarkable, because as a player, I imagine at some level, perhaps unconsciously, you're having to think about the elements differently.
Right. Well, I teach a lot of workshops, and a lot of people come and play, or master classes. You know, young people come play, and they've got their own compositions or arrangements or pieces that they're performing, and they're, you know, looking for feedback. So one of the things that I always say is, because I think as a musician, a lot of times we try to get everything at once. We try to get all the elements. We try to simultaneously get the melody, the rhythm, and all the subtleties, all the dynamics and the accents and all those things that make music really, really interesting. But a lot of times it's a good practice to tear them apart and go back. And so with solo guitar playing, for example, which is a polyphonic music usually, You have maybe a melody and a bass line and maybe some accompaniment or a third voice or some kind of harmonic accompaniment. So I always suggest that people take those apart, tear them apart. Just work on the melody a little bit. Just work on the bass a little bit. Just work on the rhythm or the accompaniment. And then reconstruct it again. And I think that process is valuable for understanding how all these elements have to happen simultaneously.
So when you're writing, one of the things that as a fan of yours for decades now, I mean, I think your first record came out in the mid or late 70s.
78.
Yeah, and that was Turning Back.
Right.
Followed by Slow Circle. And as a fan of those, one of the things that struck me was that you didn't sound like anybody else I had ever heard, and you still don't. There's, when I listen to almost any other guitarist, I can hear their influences. Well, almost any other composer, you can hear who they borrowed from, who they took this idea or that technique from. And your music just sounds so utterly fresh and novel. I wonder if you might be willing to disclose to us some of your influences and how they gave rise to your compositional and playing style.
Well,
and maybe demonstrate them as...
I like to joke that it's because I really never learned how to play anything else very well. So I had to just come up with my own. But it's true, you know, I never had a lot of repertoire as a player. You know, people, I found this out years later when I've been teaching. People come and say, hey, can you show me that solo to that Led Zeppelin thing? Or do you know how that song goes? And I'm useless at that. I'm just not very good at cataloging other people's music. But I certainly had my influences growing up. And when I started playing the guitar when I was about 12, I was a big fan of all the folk and blues, both the American and the British Isles scene. So there were people like Mississippi John Hurt and Lightning Hopkins and Sonny Terry Brownie McGee. I played a little blues harmonica.
And did you learn that kind of open tuning style and that slide style?
I did a little bit. I used to play some Book of White on a slide guitar. I don't think I'm tuned properly, and I haven't picked up a slide in a long time, so I don't want to embarrass myself or anybody else. But it was a lot of folk music and blues early on, and there were a lot of... I kind of fell in love with the sound of the steel string guitar. There's certain things that are very idiomatic that it does very well. I studied classical guitar a bit. Nylon string, and it has things that it does well. But the steel string guitar, for example, it does. We do something called a hammer on and a pull off, which is just sort of, you know,
it's a way to get
common.
Three notes for the price of one.
So
we would pluck the string once, but get three notes or four. So I always think of that sound as being sort of the prototypical steel string guitar sound. And
a very Celtic influence.
British Isles and Celtic music. And I was, you know, I learned all the Paul Simon songs and everything. And then as I got older, I started to
listen. He's a hell of a guitarist.
He's a great guitar player.
People don't realize it because he's not flashy about it. Mm-hmm. But if you sit down and you try to learn those tunes, you realize that they're really, really
it's
hard.
It's pretty involved, yeah. He's a brilliant guitar player. And I eventually got interested in jazz and all kinds of music, world music, everything. And I think maybe that's one of the other reasons I just enjoyed so many kinds of music. I didn't really have a preference. I mean, I didn't really want to be anything in particular. I didn't want to be a folk musician or a jazz or a classical musician. I just wanted to play guitar and get that sound that I was hearing in my head.
So is there a particular song of yours that you can trace back to an influence, you know, a sound you were trying to get that you heard somebody else do and you said, I want to use that?
Well, yeah, I'll just play you a few bars of a piece that I wrote back then in the late 70s. And this is very much influenced by that British Isles sound and has a lot of the Amazon. It's a short excerpt from a piece called Inverness. So. Here we go. I'm cutting it short, but that's to me, that's sort of the quintessential British Isles guitar sound. And
although in your hands, it's more harmonically complex.
It could be, yeah. I think one of the things I was trying to do is I became a big fan of Keith Jarrett when I was pretty young. I think a lot of my friends were really...
The Cologne concerts.
Yeah, and all the Bremen, Lausanne, Cologne concerts. And I thought, wow, if I could do something like that with a guitar. And I remember, actually, I was a student at UC Berkeley considering going to graduate school in economic geography and working as an intern here in San Francisco at the San Francisco City Planning Department. And I was also recording my first album, Turning, Turning Back. And I wrote this one piece called Turning, Turning Back, which for me became the title of the recording, but it also became for me, I think, the beginning of a new direction and sort of, you know, they say every musician who starts recording or writing or arranging music, you know, they have to find their own voice. And I think maybe I kind of found my own voice in that piece. So.
Are you going to play that for us?
All right, I'll play a little bit. Yeah. Just playing a little excerpt from the middle. Yeah. The middle is the double time fast part, and so the main theme. That's the main thing.
Often when I listen to guitar players, I'm trying to figure out, because I'm a guitarist myself, I'm trying to figure out what they're doing and how they're doing it. And that doesn't happen when I listen to you. The music just sort of washes over me. And I think part of it is that it's so immediately engaging and hypnotizing, really. But I think, to be fair, the other part of it is, in 1,000 years, I could never do that. there's a technical component to what you do, and I'm reminded, you must remember, there was one of your albums was reviewed by Guitar Player magazine.
Right.
And the reviewer said, I'm paraphrasing, something to the effect that listening to Alex thrusts fellow pickers to the brink of decision. Do I give up everything else in my life and practice like a madman, or do I just throw my guitar down the chasm and give up?
Yeah, well, that became a staple in my press pack way back then. You know, today, there's, to be honest, there's a lot of really talented young players out there, and the whole scene for fingerstyle guitar has developed so much that the techniques have really moved forward a lot.
Well, the interesting thing, of course, is that each generation can learn from the previous. So Leo Kottke studied John Fahey records, right?
Right.
And he became better than Fahey. And, you know, each new generation has all these great musicians to slow down and learn note by note. But on the technical side, I wonder, when you write, maybe you don't want to give away your secrets, but are you writing in real time at that tempo, or do you have to write slowly and then learn to play it faster?
I used to do everything intuitively, meaning I didn't write out music. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I'd sit down and play the guitar and fiddle around with a tuning, and I use a lot of alternate tunings, and I would come up with something that I liked, you know, and I'd sort of emerge a few hours later and say, this is what I got, you know, and so it was a very cathartic experience, I guess. But so over the years, I've become a little more analytical, and I think today my approach is sort of a balance of an intuitive process where you allow yourself to kind of empty your mind a little bit and let stuff come in, and so you can experience what's going on around you and in a way that somehow you translate that into a musical experience.
It's interesting that you talk about emptying your mind, because there was just in the last year a brain imaging study published where my colleague Charles Lim, who's a neuroscientist, put some composers in the brain scanner, an MRI machine. This is basically, if any of you have had an MRI of your body to see if there was a broken bone or for cancer detection or something like that, we have a special version of the machine called functional MRI, where we can track the flow of blood in your brain, and we put people in the scanner, and we have them do things like mentally practice their tennis serve or calculate math problems, or in my line of work, we have them think about music or listen to music. And you can track the blood flow and see which regions of the brain are active. And what Charles Lim found in these people who were either improvising music or composing, you would expect that for something that's that, I don't know, complicated or that that would require so many neural resources, you'd expect that the primary finding of his would be lots of activation in particular areas of the brain. And paradoxically, what he found was deactivation in the prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that is the editor, that's telling you, no, that's not good enough. The part of the brain that is actually inhibiting you from blurting things out. The great improvisers had turned that part of their brain off. And so just what you're telling from your intuitions as a composer, you know, science, I guess, is a step behind art. But that's what we were able to find.
I think just from a player's standpoint, one of the things when, as you develop your skills over time, maybe you're studied in the school, maybe you're a self-taught musician, but you build up a certain technique and skills. And then when you it comes time to either improvise or sit down and start to work out something musical, sometimes you have to just forget all that stuff, push it out of your mind so it doesn't get in the way. It is a handy tool to be able to bring back, though, and say, okay, what am I doing here? I'm in 3/4 time. I've got 12 measures of this, and this is like a melody, and then it's going to go to some kind of a bridge or some kind of second section. So, but a lot of times you don't want to let that stuff get in the way, so it's a delicate balance.
Now, I just wanted to clarify one point. You were talking about you use alternate tunings, and for those who don't know, there's a standard way to tune the guitar that 90% of the pieces you've ever heard on the guitar is tuned in a particular way. But there are people like Alex and David Crosby and Joni Mitchell and others who tune their guitars differently, either to spur creativity or to just play around. There's a great sense of play in that. And I think most of your pieces are in non-standard tuning, but not even among the non-standard tunings, there are even some standard ones, and you don't even use those. You have some very particular ones.
Right. Well, I think bring up an interesting point, which is I think a lot of times musicians use these alternate tunings as a way to escape what we know. Sometimes we get trapped with too much information.
To break free of the patterns.
And we say, well, I know that's a C-sharp minor chord, and that's a B-flat, you know, sharp 11, and et cetera. And then we get sort of like, well, where would I go from there? Instead of listening to maybe the experience of the image or the mood or the feeling that you're trying to convey. So these things sometimes bump up against each other. And I think when you're doing a good job as a composer or improviser, you're sticking with the image and you're not worrying too much about what the chord is.
I'm glad you used the word image because one of the things I get from your music as a listener is a strong sense of place and a strong sense of imagery. So when I listen to your music and close my eyes, I see pictures of different things. And I know a lot of people I've talked to about your music have that same experience. And so there's the sense, you know, what's been said about Japanese ink artists is that their entire emotional state is contained in the brush stroke, and that if you know how to read the brush stroke, you can tell a lot about the artist. And I wonder if that's something that you're consciously putting into the music, you're thinking of putting in imagery, or if it's something that the music gives to you and that then you're discovering it for yourself at the same time.
For me, personally, I think it's a little bit of both, really. A lot of times you just come up with something and then you go, wow, that reminds me of something. You know, it reminds me of a place I just was, or it reminds me of the desert. Or sometimes it works the other way. You go out and take a walk in the desert, and then your mind has this image of heat and a lot of horizontal lines or something, and you know, you start to translate that into as a visual image or as a tactile, you know, experience into something musical. And you know how that happens, I think, is pretty difficult to explain, but it certainly happens.
It is mysterious. And just to tie this back to the science, I had a graduate student, Bradley Vines, actually a UC Berkeley student who came to work with me at McGill. And for his doctoral dissertation, he wanted to study the extent to which we can understand what musicians are doing by looking at them and by observing their movement. And I think it's worth pointing out that there can be no music without movement. that there can be no sound without some form of movement. What sound is the molecules in the air vibrating in particular ways. There's no sound in a vacuum because there are no molecules there to vibrate. So all sound, and including music, of course, has to begin with some motion, some movement. And in the case of music, it's a body moving, or at least somebody pressing a key that moves something, or striking, or blowing, or plucking, and even singing. You know, there's movement of air through the vocal cords. So what Bradley Vines did was he took performances of musicians. In this particular case, it was a clarinetist playing Stravinsky's clarinet solo pieces. And we had people come into the laboratory, and we turned off the sound. And as they listened, they had to rate what they thought was going on emotionally and what they thought was going on structurally. And then a different group of people came in, and they had the sound on but the video off. And a third group came in, and they had both. And it turned out that the group who only saw the performance and were completely unfamiliar with the piece knew a great deal about the emotional structure, when the emotional peaks were. They knew a great deal about the tension in the piece, and they knew a great deal about where the phrases began and ended, just by looking. But when you saw and heard, the amount of information that it was conveyed was more than the sum of the parts. And we corroborated this later with electrophysiological measurements, including skin response. The amount that you sweat while, as a listener, while listening or viewing this, correlated with the emotional content of the piece.
So maybe I should pay more attention to my sweating. If I sweat more, I'm doing better job.
Huh? So, I think to the extent that your body movements are evocative of time and place and of feelings, they're naturally becoming a part of the musical stream, it would seem.
Right. You know, it's interesting because I think you and I were speaking the other day, and we talked about the word emotion, which includes the word motion in it. And we always talk about music moving people. And, you know, obviously dance music, you know, literally moves people. People get up and move. But, you know, a lot of types of music are a little more contemplative, and they move people in different ways. So no matter whether you're physically moving or not, I think something's moving. I mean, maybe you can explain what's going on in the brain or in the body, you know, the chemistry, you know, when we're going through that emotional experience, listening or playing music.
Well, on the emotional side, there's a couple of clues that we have. Cognitive neuroscience is really in its infancy here at trying to sort out music. But a couple of things we've learned recently are that there's a well-known pleasure center in the brain that we've known about since the 1950s. This is the same center of the brain you may have learned in an intro psychology class, that when you hook an electrode up to it, rats will keep pressing a bar to stimulate it, and they'll give up food and they'll give up sex and sleep to just keep pressing, you know, stimulation to this area. It's called the nucleus accumbens. And it's the same area that's activated when compulsive gamblers are winning a bet, or when drug addicts are getting their drug of choice. And it modulates the brain's own natural levels of dopamine. And my colleague Vinod Menon from Stanford and I showed that when you listen to music that you like, that you find pleasurable, the nucleus accumbens is activated, and it's modulating dopamine. And a student of mine, Valerie Salimpour, just showed in the last few months, she was able to get her hands on a radioactive tag for dopamine, so we could actually follow the dopamine in people's brains. And dopamine was increased when people listened to pleasurable music. So dopamine is involved, as many of the brain's chemicals are, in a variety of things, but among other things, it's the brain's pleasure hormone, the feel-good hormone. So I'm not saying it feels like winning a bet or taking a drug or having sex, but it's invoking the same system, which is interesting. Another thing we find is that when people listen to music together, as we all are here, oxytocin is released. Oxytocin is a hormone that's associated with bonding and feelings of trust. It's what's released when mothers are nursing their infants. Prolactin is another hormone released when mothers are nursing their infants. It's a calming and soothing hormone, and we have reason to believe now that prolactin is also released when people listen to music. So chemically, that seems to be what's going on. And another thing that's going on is, you were talking about dance and movement. Music activates the cerebellum, which is responsible for your ability to move your limbs and parts of your body to maintain a steady gait. And it's almost automatic that when music comes in at a certain pulse, neurons are going to fire in synchrony with that pulse, and they're going to make you want to move your limbs in synchrony. You know, even kids move to music. You don't have to teach them how. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you had one of your more recent records, you took some children's folk tunes.
Yeah.
And you rearranged them. And we were just talking about, I was just thinking as I talked about kids moving, do you have any of those?
Handy?
Yeah.
Well, I did both a collection of lullabies, but I think you're talking about the recording of folk songs.
Yes.
That, yeah.
The one with O Susanna.
Right. Yeah. This is let's see. I'll play a little bit of something called Single Girl, which is an old Appalachian folk song. And what I tried to do was bring the basic, the melody is there, the song is there. But I tried to bring the rhythm into a more contemporary context. So this has a little bit of a R&B feel or even a little bit of hip-hop kind of feel to it. So I'll just play you a few bars of that.
There's an obvious way in which music with lyrics tells a story, but I think certainly music, instrumental music does. I mean, that's what ballet is about, and in a way, ballet has it easier because there are dancers that get to help tell the story. But would you say that that's what you're trying to do with your music, is to tell a story?
I think so. I mean, I don't always consciously have a story in mind or an image. I do, and sometimes that's a catalyst for starting, or sometimes I'll just sort of fiddle around with an idea, and then the image sort of starts to arise in my mind as I work with it. I'll play, for example, I played a little bit of a piece from Cumulus Rising, which was from a collection called The Water Garden, and I started writing that music. This was back in 98, and I had sketched out a few ideas, and it was wintertime. It was January, and we had just moved up to Mendocino County, and it was raining for the two, 3 weeks. I mean, it was raining every day, constantly. And it took me about 2 or 3 weeks to realize that I was actually, like, sort of absorbing that sensation of water into everything that I was doing. And it sort of went, oh, I get it. This should be a whole collection of music on the theme of water. At which point I turned it around, and became a more conscious effort to make the rest of the music that I was writing sort of sound like it had some element of water, whether it was fast, slow, or still water, or whatever. The title of that collection, The Water Garden, is a very slow piece, and I always like to think that it feels like the surface of water. But I think more importantly than that, if the composer or the improviser is connecting somehow with an image or a story, no matter what that story is, the end listener who hears it is going to feel that, and they may not get the same thing. I mean, I may be thinking water, and somebody else may be thinking, you know, garbage. Or somebody might be thinking about a friend of theirs, you know. But still, they feel that connection. So something's going on there that's creating an emotional or maybe even a visual image that people are picking up on. And I'm not quite sure how that ties in with the
No, I think it's, it's an interesting point. And I think also the performance, of course, has a lot to do with it. So one can take a piece by Chopin and play it on the piano in such a rigid and robotic fashion that, I mean, sure, there's still emotion in it because Chopin wrote that in there. There's emotion in the chords and in the notes. But without the proper articulation, the piece can sound somewhat flat, and it's the performance that brings out the nuance. And I wonder, without putting you on the spot, if you'd be willing to play a piece two ways. Play it almost robotically without proper articulation and nuance and phrasing, and then play it the way you would normally play it in a concert so that we can hear the difference between what the performer brings versus what the composer brings.
I will try, Professor Levitin. this piece of the water guard that I referred to. I'll play it, try and play it mechanically first.
We didn't work this out ahead of time.
Okay, now I'm going to try and play it with at least a little more articulation and movement to it. You could tell the difference.
I wonder the extent to which it's like acting. No actor, except perhaps William Shatner, is speaking in a monotone. I mean, the idea is to breathe life and human experience into the line. I mean, that's where the art of it is.
I think so. You know, because I teach a lot of workshops and master classes, and I think this is one thing I'm always encouraging the students and the guitar players to do is to keep the music moving, you know, so it doesn't become static. So if you have a note that you're sustaining for a long time, you want to have something happening with that note. It's not just sitting there. And likewise, when you have notes in juxtaposition to each other, there's a dynamic interplay between the notes, just as there are between different musicians. So as a solo player, it's really important to accent some notes and contrast them, you know, the dynamics between that and the other notes. It's almost like the concept of pointillism in painting where, you know, you have big dots, little dots, or pixels, I suppose, would be more contemporary.
Well, concept. So you can just play a note by picking it, but there are a lot of different ways you can begin the note, and then once it's begun, there are a lot of different ways you can hold it. I wonder if it doesn't seem too reductionist, if you demonstrate different ways of starting a note and holding it.
Right. Well, I guess the term is articulation. You know, and any instrument, of course, has an articulation. Guitar, for example, I'll just pick a couple notes here. So. I'm not doing much with it here.
But if I went...
So I'm giving, in that sort of very static little pattern, which I'm making up, I'm giving some of the notes more volume. I'm sustaining some of the notes longer. I'm bending some of the notes. I'm approaching the notes a little bit different. So that, I think, is just a critical part. And it's a way of orchestrating music for the guitar, for example, a solo instrument. And one of the reasons that the guitar, I think, is such a popular instrument is you can directly control, your fingers are on the thing that's vibrating, and you can feel it, and you can feel when you're making changes to that vibration.
And then, of course, you have vibrato, too.
Yeah.
And they're different.
Yeah.
You do, yes. Let me grab another guitar here really quick.
So, for example, I always like to use this pattern. I played a little bit earlier from Turning and Turning Back. It's a double time thing. Basically, these are all the same pitch. There's three A notes that I'm playing, but I'm one's an open string and two are being fretted. So one gets a kind of drony sound. One gets like sound a little bit like a drum. It's hitting the side of a drum. And the other one gets this vibrato sound. And then there's an octave below that.
Sounds like more than one note, doesn't it?
Yeah, because you're creating a rhythmic pattern, yeah. And the rhythmic pattern works because there's not only different dynamic levels, you know, some notes are accented and played louder than others, they also have different texture. Just like any good percussionist, the tabla, for example, is a great instrument, the Indian drum, because there's so much nuance in the way it's played that it really creates a sense of depth in the rhythm.
Do you think that there's a gene for music?
Well, you're the scientist. I don't know. My grandfather was a violinist here with the San Francisco Symphony. My father was actually quite a good pianist. My brother is somewhat musical. My sister's not so musical, but...
You have a musical cousin.
I have a musical cousin. You know, so I don't really know. I mean,
Well, let me put it this way, and I'll try to stumble through a scientific explanation. But let me remind the audience at this point that we're going to take questions in 5 minutes, and there are microphones set up in the aisles, and so please be ready with your questions. If you hadn't become a musician professionally, do you think you'd still be playing?
I would... Yeah, I think I'd be playing some kind of musical instrument. I think it's, you know, I think everybody should play a little bit, you know, or sing, or, you know, just, you know, not everybody feels confident about their musical abilities, but I think it's just a really important way to connect. It is, after all, just a vibration, you know, and whether you're doing it to relax or whether you're doing it to get excited and jump up and down. I think it's a very important way to connect yourself to something a little bit bigger in life. You know, life is a constant stream of vibrations, you know, whether you're out in the traffic or sitting quietly next to a pond.
But I guess, do you feel that you had a particular talent that was innate, or is it more the case that you feel that you had an interest that was innate and you had to really work hard to achieve your ability?
Well, I think of myself as being a little bit of a not a typical musician in some ways. You know, I have a lot of friends who are very good, well-schooled, much more schooled than I am, and they read and they can play just about anything that you put in front of them. But I think maybe what I've been able to do is internalize some experiences and spit them out again on guitar in a way that hopefully, as we mentioned earlier, tells some kind of story. So I think if I wasn't doing this, maybe I'd be trying to write short stories, or, you know, I tried art and painting. I was lousy at it. I can't draw at all. But I like the idea of that. So I think I'd be doing something.
And I guess just to hammer on this point a little harder, do you think that you got to where you got because of some, I don't know, brain structure that you have that other people don't have, or did you get there by hard work?
I certainly worked hard, but I think it was more inclination. I mean, I think it was some sort of inherent sort of sensitivity or proclivity towards trying to create sound as a way of expressing who I am.
You know, there's this 10,000 hour rule that to become a world expert at anything, whether it's being a chess player or an athlete or a musician, it takes 10,000 hours of practice. And you certainly put in 10,000 hours. But how do you agree with that? Do you think that's plausible?
It sounds plausible. I know for me, I've been doing this a long time, but I think there was definitely a critical point when I was younger that I felt like I reached a certain point at which I felt like I had enough mastery over my instrument that I could accomplish what I was trying to do.
On the science side, nobody's really sure, of course, whether there's a gene for music. But two of the complicating factors are, for one, a child who grows up in a house that's full of music is going to have a very different set of learning and environmental experiences than a child who grows up in a house where music is not recognized or supported. So it becomes difficult to separate nature from nurture because of these environmental factors. And then the other thing that's interesting is that music manifests itself in so many different ways. Not all composers can play their instruments well. Irving Berlin certainly could barely play his own compositions. And not all instrumentalists compose. And then there are arrangers who don't really play an instrument or compose, and you wouldn't say they're not musical. Then you've got this whole industry of people who are musical experts, like disc jockeys and film supervisors, people who know exactly what song is going to go where, and they have what we would call musical sensitivity. But you know, it manifests itself in so many different ways that the hunt for a gene is complicated by that, right? If you're looking for a gene that might give you blonde hair, well, blonde hair is. Manifests itself in different ways, but it more or less is blonde hair. Musicality is maybe 10 or 12 different things. Plus, to become a great musician requires all kinds of personality things. You have to be willing to sit in a room by yourself for hours on end practicing. You have to have that kind of willpower. And you have to have a belief in yourself, because certainly for the first few years of musicianship, of musical training, it don't sound very good.
Yeah,
and you have to
true.
Believe it's going to amount to something. So there are all these factors have to come together that complicate the search for a gene.
Right. Well, I certainly logged a lot of hours at a certain stage in my life in playing. And
now, today, how many hours a day would you say you play on average?
It depends. I mean, it could be anywhere from none or 5 minutes to 4 or 5 hours, you know. But usually when I'm trying to prepare for something, a recording or arranging some music, I still get pretty lost. I mean, I could sit there for 2 or 3 hours without looking up too much and thinking about what time it is or where I am. So,
before we go to questions, I wonder if you'd indulge us, and just play the intro to my favorite song of yours, Causeway.
I will try.
it's been a while.
Questions.
Son. Thank you for that. That was great. I have a question, and it's kind of a two-edged question or two-sided question. When you play a piece like that, or when we hear music, we feel emotion. And why does music trigger emotion? What's going on? And related to that, you mentioned that.
Well, let's just take one at a time. So why does music cause emotion? And it's an interesting question. That's really the big question in the cognitive neuroscience of music, because it's not that all sound causes emotion. We don't put on records of chickens clucking and waterfalls falling. I mean, some of us do, but the real emotion comes from this particular arrangement of organized sound that we call music. And I have to say, we don't really know. The closest we've got is that music appears to be metaphorical for movement, and that instruments sometimes sound like a mother singing or crying or, the only thing we know for sure is that music is activating a lot of different regions in the brain, and I think that the best explanation that I'm going to propose now tentatively is that it has to do with expectation and release. So when we hear a piece of music, because music has a pulse, we almost always know when the next beat is going to be, but we don't know exactly what it's going to be. And the job of the composer is to reward us a lot of the time by playing us what we're going to expect, but violating those expectations just enough of the time, just often enough to keep us interested. And when the composer can violate those expectations in an interesting way and give us a resolution that we ourselves never would have predicted, then they've got us for life. The brain loves learning new things. It loves being taught something. And music is, in effect, teaching us there's another way to finish this phrase. And we get that burst of dopamine or whatever it is that goes, yeah.
Hi, Dr. Levelton. Earlier you mentioned that when we listen to music that we enjoy, it accesses the pleasure center of our brains. I'd be curious to know, what happens when we're listening to music that we really dislike?
Question is, if we hear music we don't like, there's a structure called the amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain, and that's activated when we hear music we don't like. People report that one of the things they hate most is music that's playing, and they can't change it. They hate music piped into airports or elevators. I mean, it's high on the list of most noxious stimuli is unwanted music. We find it aversive, and the amygdala kicks in, and it makes you want to run or scream. And like the 20th time you hear that Britney Spears song, it's just...
You talked about how in your composition you went from more of an intuitive style towards a blend of intuitive and analytical. And I was wondering, was that conscious? Or was that intuitive on its own, that process? How did that come about? Can you flesh that out just a little bit?
I think it was kind of necessity. I was asked to put together a collection of transcriptions of my music back in about 1990. And it was the first time I had to really sit down and transcribe all the music, because till then I'd done it all in my head. And the whole process, I learned things so fundamental that I didn't even know that I was doing. Like sometimes I didn't even realize that there were extra beats that I, you know, changed the meter for two bars. So in that process I learned a lot, and I think also from teaching. When you start to teach, I'd never taught when I was younger, and when you start to teach you have to really think about what it is you're doing so you can explain it to somebody else in a meaningful way. And I think that it was that process of having to transcribe the music out that made me aware that you can analyze something to benefit. But I think one still needs to be careful that analytical, intellectual side doesn't, you know, wipe out the initial urge or impulse to write music.
There's that famous story where a musicologist told John Lennon that he had ended a particular song in an Aeolian cadence. And Lennon goes, I did? As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect, and tonight we're hosting Your Brain on Music, a story of song meets science. I'm Daniel Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music, and I'm here with Alex DeGrassi, Grammy Award-nominated guitarist, and we're going to continue with audience questions.
Hi. This question's for Daniel. So you mentioned in your book and right now that music has a pulse, and I'm wondering what you think or what you know happens in the brain when music is more disjointed, like jazz, like classical music. Can you explain sort of what's going on there?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is the brain is trying to, whether you know it or not and whether you're a musician or not, your brain is trying to predict what's going to come next in music, just as it does in speech. So if I were to say, the pizza was too hot to sleep, your brain is surprised because it had a very specific prediction about what was going to come. Same thing's happening in music, and a skillful musician will break it up either tonally or harmonically or rhythmically, and when the rhythm becomes difficult to predict, it become a kind of a game for the listener and the composer that they're playing off each other. What's your feeling about that? Because you do a lot of rhythmic changes. And
right. Well, one of the things that I do a fair amount is, I think maybe the question is asking, for example, if you have a piece of music and there's a rhythmic feel and then it seems like the rhythmic feel disappears for a moment, or maybe there's a break, or maybe it comes to a cadence and then the music's played rubato for a certain period. I think there's still a flow there that as a musician you're looking for, or you're trying to convey. Sometimes it seems pretty abstract. And I would imagine that the brain is also starting to calculate what that flow. So if I play along and I'm going 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3.
The brain has to recalibrate.
And then I stop and just play something totally free. The brain's doing something to figure that out.
It's a way of engaging the audience, just like when I lower my voice like this. I'm engaging you because you're having to work a little harder to figure out what's going on. And I think that's how composers have a variety of tricks in their toolbox, and that's one of them.
Great. Thank you. I'd really like to acknowledge this book and you for doing both the research and this one he'll be selling.
Thank you.
And putting it into written form. And chapter that deals with anticipation and what you've been talking about also reflects a particularly Western approach. The Eastern, the Buddhist, a different kind of meditative approach, and also a genre of music that I've been involved in and involved in some brainwave research, other things with that, seems to elicit some other kinds of responses. Have you looked at any sorts of music that gets into the spaces between the tones and really opens up into that quantum field aspect?
Well, so the question about other musics is an interesting one. The one thing I can say about music of other cultures is that each of us is exquisitely attuned to the conventions and the rules of the music of our own culture, such that we can hear a chord sequence or a few notes and we pretty much can nail what the emotion is intended to be. To a first approximation. But if I put on Chinese opera or Indian ragas or indigenous music of the Ural Mountains, I'm probably not going to have a clue about it, and they're not going to have a clue about our music. Things that we take for granted, like minor chords being sad and major chords being happy, don't necessarily translate to other cultures. And it's the same as language. We don't understand all the languages in the world. We understand the ones that we're exposed to. And there's a critical period during the first 10 or 12 years of life one has to become acculturated to those musics. I haven't looked directly at these other musics, but there are people in the field who are, and stay tuned and we'll have news about them soon.
Thank you.
So my question is basically about how our brain remembers music. How is it processed differently? Is it stored differently than other types of memories? And I ask that sort of because I can remember songs that I sang in second grade, but I can't remember my teacher's name.
Right.
I can't remember
right.
my friends.
Well, so a lot of us have that experience. And in fact, when we go to old age homes, we see that some of the last memories that are preserved in the elderly, even with Alzheimer's disease and other decay, we see that they remember songs from their childhood, even when they can't remember their spouse's name or their age or what year it is. Part of it is that music has these mutually reinforcing cues that Alex alluded to when he was talking about the elements of music. In a good piece of music, quote-unquote good piece of music, you've got the elements of rhythm and pitch and harmony and meter and articulation and timbre all working together so that you may not remember every note, but the notes you do remember inform the missing ones, right? It becomes a pattern that's multiple cues are pointing to. So that's one thing about remembering music. The other interesting thing we found from neuroimaging studies is that when you're remembering a piece of music, it activates almost identical circuits as when you're actually hearing it. So much so that when you compare the brain activation from somebody imagining music or remembering music to somebody listening to it,
it's virtually indistinguishable from looking at the brain scan. You have to really be an expert to see it. I wonder, this brings up a question, how vivid would you say your musical imagery is? When you imagine music, Alex, is it like a little tape playing in your head?
Yeah, it is. And it works the other way, too, from the point of view of composing or trying to compose something. So, for example, I might be sitting on an airplane sometime and I'll remember some experience, maybe it was like, let's just say running or something, or running with anticipation, or something you saw. Maybe you saw something. Maybe you saw some spectacular illusion, something through of light or something, and it creates an image. And I'll try to write something down very quickly because I'm trying to capture what that is. And of course, that stuff's very fleeting. But
the other thing, of course, is that musicians feel as though those who play with an instrument like the guitar or the piano or the clarinet, something you play with your fingers, they feel as though they're remembering it in their fingers. So oftentimes you play a passage and you can't really think your way through it. You have to let your fingers do it because the muscle memory has it. Now, I want to emphasize that from a scientific standpoint, if I were to scoop your brain out of your head, your fingers wouldn't know what to do. The memory isn't really in there. But there's this motor cortex that remembers the sequence. And there's a whole active field of research on sequence learning and motor learning and how one movement is remembered as a succession in a sequence.
So what I was meaning to say is that the process of creating or trying to start creating some music is not that different for me than it is remembering music, because it's evoking some kind of image or some sense of movement.
Last question.
Can I ask, do you have any advice? I'm an amateur musician, and I have a lot of difficulty context switching from thinking about my day job, which is very, very technical, to thinking about music. If I take a week off work, it takes me a couple of days to get into it, and then I can really focus on music. Do you have any advice of how to speed up that context switch from left brain to right brain? Well, I'm assuming that Alex doesn't have, I'm hoping, that as a professional musician, he doesn't have to deal with complicated computing problems for days on end.
No, you wouldn't want me doing that, believe me. Yeah. My wife has enough trouble with me as it is.
Well, but still, you have to context switch from being in non-creative mode to creative mode, or bill-paying mode to...
No, that's definitely true, and I think you need... Sometimes you need something to just sort of wipe the slate clean. I mean, for me, sometimes it could be go taking a walk, or, these days, just disconnecting. I have a little studio, so when I go out there, it's a place where I go work, and I don't have to take my cell phone out there. I think actually having a physical location you can go to and says, this is where I do this.
Even if it's just a corner of your room. I was going to say, from a cognitive neuroscience standpoint, if you allocate a time and space to that activity and you're religious about it, at 4:30 every afternoon, I'm going to spend an hour doing my music, and I'm going to do it here. Wherever I am, whatever else I'm doing, that's my time and my place for it. Those contextual cues help quite a bit. And then maybe a little inspiration. Put on your favorite Alex Degrassi song to inspire you. Inforum is now wrapping up all of our events by asking our speakers, ourselves included, the following question. Alex, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Well, I think everybody should listen to music from other cultures. Like even Daniel has said that, we need to sort of have that imprinting when we're young, maybe to understand Balinese monkey chants or some, put it into a context. But nevertheless, I think, for me personally, I know I travel a lot. I just came back from Asia and I was given a lot of Korean music. I was in Korea, a lot of ethnic music. And I think, giving that stuff a chance and listen, trying to let it soak in, because I think even though we don't have you may not have a cultural context, if you give it a little bit of a chance, it's an opportunity to open up your mind a little bit. And I think when you do that, it may on some subconscious level give you a better understanding of why people are the way they are in different parts of the world and who they are. And so I think we should all be listening to each other's music. We should all and all try to play a little bit of music or sing. I think it's, yeah. 60 seconds then? And you, Daniel, what's your 60-second panacea?
Well, as an educator and teacher, I think my 60-second idea to change the world is better education. If we could teach the next generation of kids to be critical thinkers, to just not accept what they are told, but to decide for themselves, to give them the tools to make informed decisions about what's right and what's not, about what's been established and what's just hearsay, what really has a grounding in fact versus rumor, I think the world would be a much safer, more peaceful, and more prosperous place. Well, let's give a big final round of applause for tonight's Inform foray into neuroscience and music with myself, Daniel Levitin, and the great composer and guitarist Alex Degrassi, and with an extra round to thank Alex for sharing his musical talents with us. Now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.